Headwaters on KAXE, and today your host is Malachi Coons. It's 6 o'clock.
Good morning. President Trump returns from Israel and Egypt after receiving tributes for brokering peace. Can he now make political peace at home to end the shutdown? We asked Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia on Morning Edition from NPR News. The end of Israeli airstrikes and the return of hostages from Gaza makes for an uneasy calm in the occupied territory. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Our co-host Leah Fadel talks with two women whose lives are forever changed. Also, former Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy tells Nina Totenberg about balancing faith and the law and changing his mind. It's Tuesday, October 14th. Today in 2007, an E! Network reality series made Courtney, Kim, and Khloe feel like family in the first of 280 episodes of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says the war in Gaza is now permanently over with the release of all remaining living hostages to Israel. But as NPR's Aya Batrawi reports, the next phases of that plan need to be worked out.
Trump's plan calls for Arab peacekeeping forces to be sent to Gaza to fill a vacuum of power there after Hamas. But Egypt says it wants to see a UN Security Council mandate first. And after 2 years of intense Israeli bombardment, Gaza will need to be rebuilt from the ground up. Even if wealthy Arab Gulf states agree to cover much of that investment, it's unclear who exactly will oversee how it's spent. Another sticking point is Hamas disarmament. Before Israeli troops withdraw from inside Gaza, where they're occupying about half of the territory, Hamas will need to decommission its rockets, grenades, and other weapons. That process is still under negotiation. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
Leaders in the Reform Jewish movement, the largest denomination of Jews in the U.S., are hailing the return of hostages held by Hamas for 2 years. NPR's Jason DeRose reports.
The statement begins with a prayer. Reform Jewish leaders say they've said each of the 738 days the hostages were in captivity. Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, ruler of the universe, who frees the captives. The Union for Reform Judaism, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, and the American Conference of Cantors go on to write, while there must be accountability among leaders to prevent something similar ever happening again, for today they are putting aside the question of why this day did not come sooner. The statement also offers prayers for the, quote, innocent Palestinian civilians who have suffered and for the consistent flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
President Trump's latest tariffs have taken effect this morning. Tariffs ranging from 10% to 50% will now apply to imports of lumber, imported furniture, and kitchen cabinets. These tariffs join others imposed by Trump on imports of cars, steel, and other goods. A trade dispute between Trump and the Chinese government has accelerated. Trump says he'll soon impose a 100% tariff on imported Chinese goods. China is limiting exports of its vital rare earth minerals. A heavy storm is pulling away into the Atlantic Ocean. The nor'easter poured heavy rain from the Carolinas up to New England over the holiday weekend. There's been strong wind, surf, and beach erosion. Mark Mamorelli owns a beach house in central Delaware.
With the heavy wind and the heavy surf and the high tide, we just had an extraordinary loss of sand here on the beachfront.
In the western U.S., the remnants of a typhoon have been striking the coast of Alaska. Officials say the devastation is heavy. Some people held onto debris as they watched their homes float away. At least one person has died. Two more are missing. This is NPR. There's been torrential rain in Mexico in the past few days that has left 64 people dead. Officials say dozens of other people are still missing. The heavy rain hit five Mexican states near the Gulf of Mexico over the weekend. Mexican authorities fear the death toll will rise. President Claudia Sheinbaum says 100,000 homes have been affected by flooding and landslides. Halloween candy is pricier than ever this year. Costs are up by more than 20% since 2021. But that's not slowing down American consumers, as NPR Netta Ulubi tells us.
Candy prices are up 8% this year alone, according to the National Confectioners Association. That's largely because of a cocoa shortage from West Africa. That area produces the majority of the world's cocoa. It's been deeply affected by climate change, like extreme droughts and rain. That in turn affects big chocolate companies like Hershey, which doubled prices earlier this year. Some consumer advocates are urging Americans to buy non-chocolate treats. That could mean a lot of Jolly Ranchers for trick-or-treaters. Americans are expected to spend nearly $4 billion this year on Halloween candy. That's according to the National Retail Federation. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
Cape Verde has now become one of the smallest nations to have a team qualify for the Men's World Cup soccer tournament next year. Some 500,000 people live on the archipelago west of Africa. The Men's World Cup tournament will be jointly hosted next year by the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, The History of Jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music, and so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump is just back from a whirlwind trip to the Middle East, where he personally marked the start of a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel.
His first stop was Israel. There was much to celebrate as the last 20 surviving hostages kidnapped on October 7th were freed.
We have confronted evil together, and we have waged war together, and perhaps most beautifully of all, we have made peace together. And this week, against all odds, we have done the impossible and brought our hostages home.
Then it was on to Egypt for a separate celebration with other world leaders, including the leaders of Arab nations, key to cementing the deal that stopped the fighting. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was invited but did not attend.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now. So, Tam, President Trump landed in Israel to jubilation. So what was his role in getting this deal to the finish line?
Trump pushed this ceasefire agreement over the finish line through sheer force of will. It was a combination of Trump pressuring his close ally, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and countries like Qatar and Egypt putting pressure on Hamas to take the deal that made it come together. And Trump is now getting a lot of credit here in the U.S., even as critics are celebrating the deal. But a reminder that this is only the first phase of a multi-phase peace plan for Gaza, and there are significant areas of disagreement that haven't been worked out. The fact that Trump had to go to both Israel and Egypt to mark the moment is a sign of just how tenuous this deal remains.
Now, the war between Israel and Hamas started on October 7th, 2 years ago. President Joe Biden also tried to end it. You traveled with Biden on his Israel trip shortly after the Hamas attack. What strikes you between the two president styles here?
Yeah, that trip took place less than 2 weeks after the attack, and emotions were still incredibly raw. Before October 7th, Biden had had a long and often tense relationship with Netanyahu. But when we landed in Tel Aviv, he immediately embraced Netanyahu on the tarmac. And then after a day of very difficult meetings with the Israeli war cabinet and survivors and others, Biden delivered remarks that contained both love and support for Israel and its people, but also a warning, comparing what had happened to Israel to 9/11 in the U.S.
But I caution this: while you feel that rage, don't be consumed by it. After 9/11, we were enraged in the United States. While we sought justice and got justice, we also made mistakes.
Biden was basically warning Netanyahu to be careful not to get Israel pulled into an extended conflict that would have a high toll in civilian lives. But of course, that is exactly what happened.
Yeah, there have been other brief ceasefires before. What will you be watching for in this one?
A big question now is whether this time is different. A lot of people think it is. Israel has gotten all the hostages out, and Hamas is now thoroughly depleted. And by making this trip to the Middle East, Trump has invested significant political capital in this peace being a lasting one. But for this to hold, President Trump can't just take the win and move on. He's going to have to stay engaged and keep applying pressure. And that is something he hasn't always done.
And then he returns to a government shutdown with really what? No end in sight.
Yeah, as you say, it is not clear where the exit ramps are for this government shutdown. The White House amped up the pressure on Democrats by announcing widespread layoffs. But if that was meant to get Democrats to cry uncle, it failed. Instead, it's hardened positions. Presidents having difficulty at home often look overseas for relief. And Trump certainly got to enjoy being exalted in the Middle East. Now at home, he's proceeding as if there's no shutdown at all. He'll be posthumously awarding the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Charlie Kirk today.
All right, that's NPR's Tamara Keith. Tam, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
While President Trump shook hands, took pictures, and gave a thumbs up with world leaders in Egypt, the government remained shut down in the United States. House Speaker Mike Johnson said to reporters yesterday he is not ready to negotiate with Democrats.
We're barreling toward one of the longest shutdowns in American history, unless Democrats drop their partisan demands and pass a clean, no-strings-attached budget to reopen the government and pay our federal workers.
Workers who have started to receive partial paychecks. A lot of those workers, both civilians and members of the military, live in Virginia. So we've called Senator Tim Kaine, who represents the Commonwealth in the Senate. He's a Democrat. He's with us now. Good morning, Senator. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Michelle. Great to be with you. Thanks.
So it's now day 14. Virginia, as we said, has a lot of federal workers. More than 4% of the people who don't work on farms work for the federal government in your state. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And Virginia is second only to California in the number of active duty military in the state. That's according to the Department of Defense. These are your constituents. I have to assume you're hearing some things from them. What are they telling you?
Michelle, yeah, I was on the road. The Senate is still in session. Of course, the House has been out for weeks, but we were on the road for the holiday weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and yesterday. And I talked to a lot of Virginians, and they're very, very troubled by this situation. But they've been troubled since Donald Trump became president in January. The layoffs, the clawbacks of federal public health funding, the cancellation of economic development projects. This didn't start when the shutdown started. It started on Donald Trump's inauguration day. And what my constituents are saying to me is, you know, get a deal that the White House will honor and get a deal as a result of some real negotiation between the White House and Congress. You can't let the White House say Democrats have to just accept whatever we say. The president has not meaningfully engaged in the negotiation at all. And that's what always happens when you want to find a funding deal. The president's got to engage.
So the president says on one specific issue, the president says he's identified funds that will ensure that active duty military get paid tomorrow. The administration is reportedly using some $8 billion of unused research and development funds to pay for this. First of all, do you think this shifting of funds is legal? And if you don't, what's the recourse there?
Michelle, I think it probably is legal. There's a second set of funds in the reconciliation bill this summer. We added money to the Pentagon budget and some of it was undesignated. Since Mike Johnson has said he won't bring the House back even to pass a military spending bill, I think that the president needs to find something with the House absent to make sure military get paid. And I think unallocated funds is a good way to do that.
You support that?
Yes.
You're not concerned that that creates kind of a wedge between military members and civilians?
If you were taking money away from other priorities, I would be nervous about it. But I think Virginians would generally support the notion that troops who stand the risk of being in harm's way with monies that are available at the Pentagon, those dollars could be used for them.
So the Republicans are framing this, as we just heard, as a partisan demand for an unaffordable program that they don't agree with. The Democrats are framing this about keeping health care affordable. But even if Democrats were to vote for a so-called clean CR, clean bill, it just kicks the can down the road. I mean, open enrollment starts on November 1st. These programs have to be priced out. I'm just trying to understand, what is a scenario where the substance of this actually gets worked out? I mean, is it President Trump getting directly involved in cutting a specific agreement? Is it members like yourself working across the aisle? How do you envision this actually gets worked out?
Michelle, it has to be with the president's engagement, because Republicans are afraid to do anything unless the president blesses it. And I want to make clear, this is not a demand. The Democrats put an alternative on the table. President Trump told the House, write a budget deal without Democratic involvement. We didn't wait around. We put an alternative on the table on September 18th that said, hey, let's fix this health care mess you've created. And let's also make sure that a deal is a deal. If we shake hands, the White House has to follow it and can't immediately start laying off more people. We want the president to engage. The only thing he did after canceling one meeting was have a meeting on the 29th of September, a day before the end of the fiscal year. And as soon as the Democrats walked out of the meeting, he started to put up artificial AI-generated videos making fun of them, putting sombreros on their heads, etc. Mm-hmm. You can't solve this with the president unengaged. And all of the earlier deadlines we've reached, when Joe Biden was president, we never had a shutdown because he'd get congressional leaders in the Oval Office and work out a deal. When Donald Trump last shut down the government in 2018, 2019, eventually he realized he needed to forge a resolution, and he did. If the president engages, we can solve this in 48 hours.
So before I let you go, briefly, polls at the moment show that Americans are blaming Republicans more than Democrats for the shutdown. The longer this goes on, do you think that might change?
In Virginia. So in Virginia, folks are very conditioned to believing all these negative consequences are choices by Donald Trump, because he started doing it on day one with a OMB director, Russ Vogt, who says his goal was to traumatize federal employees. They've made good on that promise. I think Virginians know who to blame.
That is Senator Tim Kaine. He's a Democrat from Virginia. And I want to note, we invited several Republican lawmakers to take our questions. We will continue to ask. Senator Kaine, thank you.
Glad to be with you. Thanks.
Pakistani and Afghan forces exchanged fire across the border over the weekend, killing dozens, according to authorities there. It's an escalation of an already precarious relationship between the South Asian neighbors. Betsy Joles has more from Islamabad.
The border conflict started 2 days after multiple explosions were reported inside Afghanistan on Thursday. Afghan officials blamed Pakistan for the blasts and fired on its border posts in retaliation. Both sides traded deadly fire on fire. It was the most heated exchange between the countries in years. But it didn't come out of nowhere. Pakistan has been struggling to control a deadly insurgency in its mountainous border region with Afghanistan. That's the area where the TTP is active. They're known as the Pakistani Taliban. And Pakistan blames the Taliban government in Afghanistan for providing them a safe haven. The TTP have turned up attacks inside Pakistan since the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021. Pakistan has neither confirmed nor denied it was behind the strikes in Afghanistan on Thursday. Residents of Pakistan's border region with Afghanistan have been uprooted by months of intermittent crackdowns against the TTP by Pakistan's security forces. Sanaullah is from Dattakale in North Waziristan, a volatile region in northwest Pakistan where a recent campaign against the TTP took place. He says some people from his area were given 3 hours to evacuate last month as militants entered their area and Pakistan security forces went after them. They left in a rush without being allowed to take any belongings with them, he says. They are now staying in a nearby village. They've been told by authorities that it's safe to return, but they're reluctant. They don't want to be displaced again. Sanaullah, like many others in the region, fear things might only get worse if tensions with Afghanistan escalate further. For NPR News, I'm Betsy Joles in Islamabad.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
6:19, we're listening to Morning Edition from National Public Radio. Coming up, we'll get the news from National Public Radio at 6:30. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. We'll be bringing you as well the student phenology from around the region. Doesn't mean that we don't want to hear from you. What are you seeing in nature? What are the changes? What are you looking forward to in the season ahead? Or not looking forward to, I guess. You can text us 218-326-1234. I keep trying to keep myself positive about winters in northern Minnesota. Support this morning comes from Lady Sippers NA Bottle Shop, located in downtown Deer River. Itasca County's only NA Bottle Shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info available at ladysippers.com. Support for KXC also comes from the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. They play a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs. They award $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our region. More information is available at gracf.org. Coming up later today at 9 o'clock, we bring you Headwaters, and that is followed by The World Cafe. It's all here on People Powered KAXC. Help us out with your donation now. Go to KAXC.org.
For NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Amazon Prime Video, presenting Lazarus from mystery writer Harlan Coben, a tale of lies, murder, and long-buried family secrets, starring Sam Claflin and Bill Nighy, premieres October 22nd on Prime Video. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. In Gaza, the sky is finally quiet now that a ceasefire is in place. No drones, no airstrikes. And now Palestinians say they may finally have space to mourn, to take stock of all that's been lost. But what will life be like on the other side of war? We spoke with two women in Gaza who shared what they're feeling during this fragile time of transition. Shruq Al-Ayla is a Palestinian journalist, and when I reached her, she told me right now, everything feels unreal.
I am in hangover mode. It was so weird this morning because I got the chance to have, you know, a deep sleep with no airstrikes and explosions, and that felt really weird.
Shruk's husband, Rushdie Sarraj, was killed 16 days into the war when their home was bombed. Shruk and her infant daughter, Dania, had to survive alone.
Well, actually, what we have endured during this genocide, the displacement, the famine, all of these things were able to shower me with depression.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason that kept me resisting is Dania, and she, like, even in the times that I was unable to carry on, she gave me the reason to continue to never stop.
Dania was not even a year old when this all started. So what has her life been like?
Dania spent more than half of her age with no drinkable water, with no medical supplies for her illness, with no milk, with no diapers. And because of the famine, she grows up on canned food. She doesn't recognize the apples, the banana, and all the other kind of fruit. But what I'm talking about is 2 years of feeling guilty for not being enough for my daughter, for not being able to secure her with all of her basic needs.
In Gaza, she says they haven't been measuring time in days or months. They've measured the passing of time in minutes.
Because every single minute is a sign of being, of surviving. So what I was relying and still actually functioning on is surviving.
She says it's difficult to transition from just trying to survive
to figuring out how to live again. We also heard that from Shema Ahmed. She's a college student we've been checking in with throughout the war, and yesterday we got in touch again. So it's the first time that you're able to really take stock of what's happened and grieve?
I don't think we're allowing ourselves to, because it's really hard to face these feelings, because there's just so much piled up. But now it's the first time that we're actually trying to face a little bit of it, because even the ones that we lost, we still don't realize, and we still didn't fully take it in that we lost them. And even the locations that used to hold so many memories that are now out of reach, it's, you know, it's something that we've been just trying to put into this box of so many feelings that we couldn't face with, like, surviving and facing feelings with something that we couldn't do. So it was our survival mechanism to just bury that in. Mm-hmm. So with it now surfacing, you know, us just trying to deal with it is really, really hard. But alhamdulillah, that's what we keep saying.
Shema, how many members of your family did you ultimately lose?
Well, my family is a really big one. We lost about 70 from my extended family. I lost my grandmother, two of my uncles, a lot of my cousins. Some of them went missing. Some of them are still under the rubble. And even those we buried, like my two uncles who were buried in graves. Now, when we returned, the graves were basically turned upside down, and we can't even visit their graves anymore because we couldn't find the graves or the place to mourn them at.
What is it like to finally have the airstrikes stop after it's been, I think, more than 7 months since the last ceasefire? And do you think this one is different, that it will last?
Yeah, we hope it does, because if it gets broken again, we don't know how to feel then. It is still not, you know, something that we can say, yeah, we finally feel safe. We finally feel like this is not going to happen again. So we can't say we're fully at peace at the moment. And we hope they don't go back on their words this time and break the ceasefire again, because we really can't bear it anymore.
Shema says her home and neighborhood were destroyed early in the war. She and her family have been displaced 11 times in 2 years.
Just a moment before you called me, actually, I was scrolling through Instagram and seeing the footage from the north of Gaza. We still didn't get the luxury of returning there because Shujaia, the neighborhood where I used to be, is completely out of reach, especially in the first phase. And hopefully it will become reachable in the second.
Out of reach because the Israeli military is still there?
Yes, because the occupation is still there. And they're shooting anyone who gets close. And right now, literally, we have no place to go back to in the north. We really wish we can go back, but it's still not an option.
When you think about the days ahead, Shemat, you know, when we first started talking, you had thought you would go back to college within a few days, and then ultimately you started studying online, if you could get online. I mean, what is a future that you see now, if you see a future?
Yeah, actually, I'm about to graduate. I managed to finish university during these 2 years, despite the delay and despite the university being out of reach online. Because really, during this genocide, we were surviving, but at the same time, we needed something to give us purpose, to make us feel like our life is not just reduced to that mere survival, to really have it have meaning and have purpose. So that was something that really pushed us forward. So alhamdulillah, I'm about to graduate. To us, this land holds so much meaning. And seeing it, like you seeing Gaza, is just really gray and full of rubble and dirt everywhere. But still we see a future.
That was Shema Ahmed, a college student, and Shuruq Al-Aila, a widowed mother and journalist, both in Gaza. This is NPR News.
When crowds become dense, it can be challenging to move around or leave because of the laws of physics. One scientist set out to better understand human crowds by studying the movements of herds of sheep.
Flow, jam, clock, flow, jam, this kind of behavior.
I'm Andrew Limbong. That's on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE with your local host, Jennifer Barr. I'm Heidi Holton, and joining me now is John Latimer, who is broadcasting from the North Shore. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Heidi. It's going to be a beautiful day. The sun is, still an hour below the sun, but below the horizon, but there's a gorgeous band of deep coral orange right at the horizon, and the clouds are starting to pick up a little of the color. It's going to be a lovely morning.
Well, we're seeing increasing clouds moving through the day because we may have some rain tonight. Our high's 50 to 52. Overnight, we're going to be in the lows in the upper 30s to low 40s. Highs in the mid to upper 50s on Wednesday and some sun, and then showers likely on Thursday. Highs 59 to 67 around the region, and a little warmer on Friday as well. So we'll check in with Tornado Bob later this morning and talk about the big weather picture. And looks like it's going to be some good days here. We need some rain, that's for sure.
Have you not had rain yet? I've been gone for 5 days, so left Thursday.
We had rain on Sunday. Yes, it rained yesterday. Yesterday was not Sunday. We had yesterday off. It did rain on Sunday, not a lot.
Okay.
I might be wrong on that. It might have been when I was sleeping, John. So who knows?
Well, we had rain here on Sunday night.
Yeah.
And it must have rained for, I don't know, an hour, but it wet the deck, and that was about it. I didn't see puddles or anything like that. We walked up to Devil's Kettle yesterday. And there was a bit of water on the trail here and there, but sometimes those are just seeps. Sometimes that's just water that, you know, flowing out on top of the rocks and comes out on the trail. So hard to say. It was a gorgeous hike, that's for sure.
Oh, you've been enjoying the North Shore then?
I have been, and I've kind of, I have moved, where have I moved? Backwards in time. I am seeing, you know, maples in full color, and the aspens are bright yellow, and the sugar and red maples are both colorful. The undergrowth is dominated by red osier dogwood. Bush honeysuckle, all of those are in brilliant color, which is completely back home. The bush honeysuckle is bare, and so are the maple trees, and the aspens are quite yellow, I would imagine. They were yellowing when I left, so
yeah,
I would expect that you're probably full yellow. You look at the hillsides here, and they're just alive with color. It's gorgeous. Huh.
We still have a lot of orange and reds on our maples at our house. So I'm enjoying that. And I was on the North Shore, second week of September. No colors there, but beautiful. Doesn't matter what time of year when you're at Minnesota, the ocean of Minnesota, right?
Yeah. Oh, we've had so much fun. My grandson and I were being chased by waves yesterday.
Oh,
running down into the sand and then dashing back up. Oh, we both got wet to the knee.
So no swimming for you in Lake
Superior? I didn't swim, but my grandson did.
Okay.
I didn't feel a need. And actually, only the first day that we were here was the lake kind of calm enough to get out and sort of splash around in it. The last few days, the waves have been, I suppose, three feet or a little better. And
wow.
And pretty, you know, they're thrashing the shores pretty good. So it was kind of fun to watch and to appreciate how all those stones get reduced and rounded.
Yeah. Is there a lot of rock picking going on with your grandson?
Oh, my word, yes. We had to draw a line. Actually, my son took home a rock that, it didn't weigh as much as me, but it was a pretty, pretty big, heavy rock.
Well, yeah. Coming up, we're going to have National Native News. We've got student phonology reports for you in this hour and in next hour. And Pam Perry's going to be joining us. We're talking birds, and that's coming up at about 8:40. So if you would like to Tell us about the birds that you are seeing. You can text us at 218-326-1234.
Support for KAXE comes from Lady Sippers N.A. Bottle Shop, located in downtown Deer River, Itasca County's only N.A. bottle shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info available at ladysippers.com. And support for KAXE comes the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation, playing a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs. Awarding $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More information at gracf.org.
Coming up on National Native News, we're learning about how Indigenous health workers are stepping up their battle against opioid addiction. Stay tuned for that story. But John, first, I have a story for you about what happened last night. It somewhat involves the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. It was the 100 Women Who Care event. I think we were announcing that last week when we were on together. This is a nationwide movement. It's happened twice in the Grand Rapids area. It's happened in Nisswa and I think Bemidji, and Walker was last night as well. Women gather, you pay $100. You choose the top three nonprofits. And then there is a vote of those. And whatever money's raised goes to that nonprofit. Free and clear, no strings attached of what you have to do with that money. And if I back up a little bit, about a week and a half ago, Chelsea Perkins, Megan Buffington, and I were at the AAUW Northeast, the regional gathering, and spoke about news and the importance of local news and kind of the threat to the press at this moment in time. And they took us up they fell in love with what was happening at KXE, and it was a spark for them. I want to thank Kathy, who reached out immediately and said, we're going to nominate you guys at this event. You can't nominate yourself. Like, KXE had nothing to do with this whole thing.
Pick me.
Yeah. We won last night. We won over $17,000. To KXE, especially in the face of losing federal funding, there were tears. I mean, there were tears before we even won. I could not believe these women that supported us and wanted to make sure. And then the exciting thing was the Itasca Area Cancer Crisis Fund also won that much. There was a generous donation right before the announcement of someone who was matching the amount. So much great stuff in our community. They run it like clockwork. It's an hour event is all. Like, you just boom, boom, boom. You get through it, and it's amazing. And I cannot thank the community enough for this to keep us going. We will use it wisely, as we do any of the funds that we get, to keep our mission going, bringing you student phonology reports from around the state of Minnesota, bringing you great music, local news that you're not going to get anywhere else. You know, our reporters are reporting on county board meetings, city meetings, school board meetings, things that, you know, do not get a lot of reporting these days. Megan's even told us that she's gotten thank yous from county boards of, like, no one's ever come to this before, city boards. No one's ever been here or reported on this before. So thank you to everyone who was there last night, and especially to Kathy for making this happen. I just don't know what to say. It was amazing.
Thank you, and we will continue the hard work. That's what you said.
Yeah, we will. That's for sure.
That's astonishing. And to that end, I came down from hiking up to the Devil's Kettle on the Brule River yesterday. There was a fellow sitting on a bench there. I sat down next to him. I started looking at a flower that was right there at the end of the bench. I was trying to identify it. An aster, of course. And I started talking to this fellow, and it turns out he was a teacher from Minneapolis. He taught fourth grade. I talked about phenology, and Charlie's going to be thrilled. We have another school.
Wow. That's amazing. See, this is what happens when you talk about nature and connect with people. It's a way to meet people too, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Coming up, we've got National Native News, and then we'll begin our student phonology reports. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is the Tuesday Morning Show.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous health workers are stepping up their battle against opioid addictions. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Jenny Kenzie reports, tribal communities are looking for solutions to the ongoing crisis.
Indigenous people have been especially hard hit by the national opioid epidemic. Their use is highest among all U.S. populations, and use has been increasing dramatically in recent years. Chris Lovato is a community health representative on the Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico. Lovato says the problem is widespread and has even tracked opioid addictions in children as young as 9 and 13.
We did experience the 13-year-old hallucinating, just kind of not coherent. And, you know, of course, 911 was called. And after a couple of days, we got the, you know, information that he was high on meth.
Funds to fight the crisis come from the federal government's Tribal Opioid Response Program and settlements from lawsuits against opioid manufacturers and distributors. 5 tribal nations in New Mexico and more from out of state are expected to attend a summit on the Santa Ana Pueblo to look for solutions in November. I'm Jenny Kinsey.
The Phoenix, Arizona area is increasingly becoming a hub for data centers powering artificial intelligence. And as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, even tribes are beginning to tackle the trade-offs.
From language and culture to tribal courts and health, the applications are seemingly endless.
There's not been a conference on AI in Indian country at all, to my knowledge. And so this is really the first time bringing people together.
Tracy Morris, who is Chickasaw and executive director of ASU's American Indian Policy Institute, says she and her team will draft a white paper on takeaways from the day-long Wiring the Res gathering in downtown Phoenix. Among them was critical dialogue about natural resources, a topic initially missing from the agenda, but later added.
After we saw stuff on our social media saying, well, what about what it's doing to the environment? I'm like, okay, let's add a panel. We got space.
Chris Deschini, who is Navajo and executive director of the National Intertribal Energy Council, says few tribes are in the position to consider building data centers on their lands.
Most of Indian country is not impacted by this, but it does impact, for example, if you have utility rates.
Arizona Utilities, APS, and Tucson Electric Power are now proposing a 14% hike for ratepayers, largely driven by rising energy demands from data centers. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Events were held over the weekend and continue through Monday across the country to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. In Berkeley, California, Saturday, the annual Indigenous Peoples Day powwow and Indian market was held. It included intertribal dancing, contest dancing, native foods, arts, and crafts. Organizers say this year's powwow marks 33 years of the holiday, honoring ancestors, people of today, and future generations. In Nevada earlier this year, state lawmakers passed a bill to officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day as the second Monday in October, but the governor vetoed the measure. According to Native Voters Alliance Nevada, the Native community is still celebrating and invited elected officials, allies, and the greater Las Vegas community to kick off Indigenous Peoples Day at the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign to honor the holiday. The event includes a ceremonial lighting, speakers, and a preview of future legislative plans. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding from the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer.
We receive support from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. And programming is supported in part by the Judy Garland Museum, located on Highway 169 in Grand Rapids, featuring Judy Garland's 1920s childhood home and a gallery of Judy and Wizard of Oz memorabilia, including the original carriage from the film. Visitor information is available at judygarlandmuseum.com.
Coming up will be student phonology.
Like an old hobo on the sad, lonesome and blue. I was fair as a summer day. Now the summer days are through. You pass through places, and places pass through you. But you carry them with you on the soles of your traveling shoes. Well, I love you so dearly, I love you so clearly. I'll wake you up in the morning so early just to tell you I got the wandering blues. I got the wandering blues, and I'm gonna quit these rambling ways one of these days soon. And I sing the littlest birds sing the prettiest song.
I don't know if there's truth to that, John, that the littlest birds sing the prettiest songs.
I have to admit my audio was a bit choppy and I may have spoken at the wrong time.
Oh, there. No. No, I did not hear you during that. But, yeah. So it is Tuesday morning, 6:46, and it is time for our student phonologies, the first incarnation of it. You also hear us an hour from now as we've got lots of reports that came in this week.
Lots to talk about when it comes to phenology. Funding for student phenology is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. Our first report comes from Alexandra Stout's class at Apple Blossom School in Bemidji.
Hello. This is Strother.
And Oren
from Apple Blossom Village.
Here are our observations for the second week of October.
Lots of leaves and foam and algae in Lake Irving.
Lewis thinks birds are migrating because he is seeing less of them. I saw that an orange hawkweed was partially closed. I think it was cold.
Layla felt the cold wind blowing. The ground is covered in leaves. The basswood is bare. The willows are half bare.
Lots of ways on the lake. Woa saw one mallard and two ducklings. We all noticed the frost on the ground
this morning.
Thanks for listening to Apple Blossom Phenology Report.
Nice report. Thank you, kids. That was great. It was good to hear that in fact, basswoods are bare, and they're bare in the Grand Rapids area as well. The ground is definitely covered in leaves, and that, I don't know, there's that smell in the fall that is sort of, I suppose, the decomposition of all of those leaves that have fallen. There are many, many, many critters are after the nutrients that are in those leaves. And sometimes it leaves a pretty nice smell in your ears. Some ducklings seen, some waves and foam on the lake. Just a lot of things going on in the Bemidji area. And thank you, children, for that great report. Our next report comes from Allison Ofterheide's class at Cherry School near Iron Junction.
Hi, this is
Gavin,
Jed,
Izzy,
and Kenna,
reporting from Cherry School in Iron Junction.
Minnesota on October 9th, 2025.
We have been noticing that it's been getting colder. We need to start wearing jackets, and on Wednesday we noticed the first killing frost. Everything looked white in the morning, and the grass was crunchy. We could see our breath in the cold.
On October 6th, Scarlett saw a blue jay in her backyard near Cherry. On October 7th, Jed heard coyotes from his backyard near Cherry. On October 4th, Gavin saw two dead raccoons on the road near Cherry. Later, he saw eagles scavenging on the raccoons. On October 5th, Miss Carrie noticed tamarack needles beginning to turn orange near Buell.
Today, during our walk in the school forest, we noticed that speckled alder was about 70 to 80% bare. We did not see many frogs or bugs when we were outside.
This concludes our phenology report. This has been
Gavin,
Jed,
Izzy,
and Kenna
reporting from Cherry School.
Nature rules!
Thanks, kids. Nice report. I'm especially pleased that you've been watching the speckled alder, and they're a little kind of difficult to get a handle on because the leaves on the alders don't turn color. They just drop. They're green and they fall. And so having the constant, well, not constant, but having that repetitious look at them will allow you to notice that there are fewer and fewer leaves on them as you go into fall. The tamaracks on October 5th were starting to turn orange near Buell. When I went through on the 8th, they were kind of yellow in the Cherry area. I went by your school on the 8th, and I noticed that the leaves were kind of yellow over there as well, beginning to change. So we are, I guess, between the willows and the tamaracks, fall is not far off or not long with us, I guess. We may be done with fall before too much longer. Our next report comes from Nate Lindner's class at Cohasset Elementary School.
Hello, I'm Kendallin and
Henry.
We are in Mr. Lender's fifth grade science classroom at Cohasset Elementary School. We have made lots of observations over the past week.
We are excited to share our first phenology report of our school year. We have been observing the changes that come with our fall. Our class noted that our first hard frost was on Tuesday, October 7th. We had frost on the ground and temperatures getting as low as 25 degrees. We are also tracking the last sightings of animals and insects. Right now, the only first and last items we have observed were our first migrating geese on 9/20.
Our class has noticed that animals are getting ready for winter by seeing squirrels gathering food, and we're not seeing as many birds as in the summer. So we also noted that the deer are getting more active as we have seen more deer in fields and near roads. The last item we wanted to discuss was our study of roots. We grow lima beans without soil. We noticed that the roots are not linear and have different levels of sprouts trying to get nutrients.
Thank you for listening to our phenology report. We are looking forward to another week of observations.
Like Mr. Latimer always says, onward and awkward.
Onward and awkward indeed. And those guys are the onward part. I am the awkward part. But we have a good time getting out, and they have been noting a lot of things, and they do have a nice list of firsts and lasts, and we have worked with them on noticing the last of something, which is always the most difficult. So you have to note its presence, and then one day you will remember that, oh, we haven't seen that thing for this many days, and maybe that was our last one, and it will be fun to hear from them and to hear more about what they find. Their study on roots was really interesting, and I have some questions that I'm going to direct to some higher ups in the root business and see if we can't come up with some answers to some of the questions that came about from their experiment. Our next report comes from Colin Cody's class at Easton Elementary School in Grand Rapids.
Hello, my name is Araya. This is our phonology report from Mr. Cody's third grade classroom at East Rapids Elementary. Thursday the 2nd was hot, hot, hot. We checked several trees for color. Our classroom thought the silver maple was 41% colored. The red maple and burnt oak had more and even some leaf loss. The red oak, willow, and buckthorn had very little change. We saw dragonflies and found a dead raven. In local aspen stands, I've noticed leaves starting to fall. All for now, Mr. Cody's third grade classroom.
Thank you, Araya. That was a very nice report. I had the children estimate the silver maple, and every one of them had to make an estimate of how many of the leaves they thought were colored. And then we added up all of their estimates and divided by the number of students, and we came up with 41%, which, from my own observations, wasn't that far off. I had it at greater than 25%, and I think it's fine. Great exercise in math for them. Our next report comes from Lori Lagergren's class at St. Joe's in Grand Rapids.
Hi, my name is Avery.
And I'm Claire.
We are students at St. Joseph's Catholic School in Grand Rapids.
This week, we noticed that our red maple is 25% colored, with 30% of the leaves fallen.
The three-year-old needles of our pines are yellowing and falling.
The seeds of the tamarack are falling, and the needles are turning yellow.
Our big tooth aspen is 10 to 20% yellow. We learned that aspen leaves are flat, not round. And this is what makes them flutter in the wind. We are amazed to find how much pollen a big tooth aspen puts out, 1 billion.
The balm inside of the balsam poplar smells like honey mustard. It can be used as medicine if you mix it with animal fat and rub it on, like you would vapor rub.
Do you know how to identify poison ivy? One thing to know is that the teeth on their leaves are irregular.
We have big blue stem grass growing in our school field. It is also known as turkey stem because it looks like a turkey foot.
We saw a red male dragonfly.
Claire saw a meadowhawk red dragonfly.
On October 8th, Ella, Mabel, and Avery saw a monarch butterfly.
October 8th is also the first frost. Until next time, be observant, responsible, and adventurous outside.
Thanks, Avery. Claire, nice report. We did see some of those meadowhawks while we were out, and we shook some seeds out of the tamarack cones. Tamaracks are starting to turn color there. It's quite lovely, and we will be keeping an eye on those and the maples as we go into fall a little deeper.
Coming up, we're going to have the Up North report. We've got a special announcement, though. We just heard from Steve from St. Paul, Como.
Big favor. Can you do a single early best wishes happy anniversary to my wife, Mary Sue, for me around 7 to 7:10? She's a teacher and usually misses this part of the show as she's at school by then. Thanks.
Wow.
We're really happy to wish Mary Sue a happy birthday today, happy anniversary, and best wishes to you and to Steve.
Yeah, Steve was at the Grand Rapids River Fest. I don't know if Mary Sue was, but Mary Sue, we wish you the best day today with your students. Hope it's a good day, and thanks for being a part of KEXE. We sure appreciate it. Coming up, we will have the Up North Report. You get local news every morning at this time. And then we also will be bringing you more from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org.
Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. And support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m. More information is